Coming up next on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome to Apropos of Something. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, Resistance Radio, and you know I love to say Persistence Radio as well. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We have an outstanding and important show today about justice, borderlands, and music. We'll speak with Tracy Howe. She is a musician, activist, and founder of Restoration Village Arts. And we are the first to announce, I just heard this breaking news, she has a new album dropping March 1st. We're going to discuss that and her immigration work, which she's been doing for about 20 years, her recent trip to Tijuana, and one upcoming to Honduras. Tracy is a recording artist using her music to communicate struggle and hope, beauty and brokenness. And we talk with Angela Chalfi, executive director of the Legal Aid Justice Center in Charlottesville, seeking equal justice for all. She's a tour de force, a prolific and fierce advocate for justice, often leading many of LAJC's signature cases. Today, we're going to speak of many of those, from reducing racial inequities around school discipline to fighting to release children being held by the government and reuniting them with their families and much, much more. And Nancy Lawrence, speaking of doing justice and music to my ears, I'd like to hear your voice. Are you there?
Ellen, I am here. I am here. I must say, this morning you're describing is jam-packed, and I thought yesterday morning when I awoke was jam-packed. And
exactly.
Obviously, I was only in preparation for
right.
What's in store in the 60 minutes.
What I say to that is, who says good things don't happen in Florida?
Oh, my God. That is brilliant. Absolutely. Absolutely.
He is
exactly.
Just
who and it was just so heartening to know that FBI agents will volunteer for witch hunts as well.
Exactly. Doing it without being paid, you know, learning so much more about this guy, political operator on the dark side. He was arrested, of course, Friday after being indicted on 7 counts. And as Richard Painter said, it looks like it directly implicates the Trump campaign in a conspiracy to disseminate emails stolen by Russia in 2016.
There's just a few more indictments to come, and it was incredible. And on the same day that the commander in crime took the mantle officially.
Right.
Was amazing, you know, and caved to the speaker.
And no coincidence.
As the New York Post called him, the caveman.
Right.
His local paper.
Right, exactly. Anyway. And Richard, Richard Painter's just in my mind lately because he said before, weeks ago about Trump, his goose is cooked. He tweeted, the man who played dirty tricks and set up false accusations against good people for 45 years is going down. And his advice is to cooperate with Mueller and cover up that Nixon tattoo on your back at all times.
Congress just has to write like an article-esque level deterrent, you know, that with the take the pen with the feather, just something that removes this tactic of taking American hostages and using
exactly
them as,
yeah, there's some bills,
you know, anyway.
Bills to do that. It really irks me that they call him a dirty trickster, though, because he's really so much worse than that. We don't have time to go all into it, but some words to describe him are the dark satanic prince of the 80s and described as the icon of McCarthyism and called the essence of pure evil. Those are some of his monikers.
all due for maybe he won't, but it's like he's just due for a serious radio talk show.
Oh, I know.
20 years, I know.
Anyway, I hope he gets the wall that he deserves. So I wanted to mention this great event that I just found out about. Richard Guy Wilson, one of our favorite guests. He is leading tour of the Academical Village today, and the rarely seen Georgia O'Keeffe paintings from her time at the University of Virginia at the Fralin Museum. It starts with a lecture at 1 o'clock at Campbell Hall, and then followed by the walking tour of the lawn and Academical Village around 2:30. Nancy?
Sounds great.
Just something. You know, just give me
it
something.
Sounds great. I would be lying if I said I'm going to go.
Okay.
But it does sound great. That
right.
is not a lie.
You're a little far. Anyway, with no further ado, our first guest is Tracy Howe. She's a musician, theologian, and pastor. She uses her music to communicate struggle and hope, beauty and brokenness. She's a minister for community and congregational engagement for justice and witness ministries in the national setting of the United Church of Christ. She is also the founder of Restoration Village Arts, a retreat, learning, and action community for artists and ministers who work to achieve racial justice, eco-justice, queer justice, and borderlands justice. She has a new album, which I alluded to, called Things That Grow, coming out March 1st. She's been working along the U.S.-Mexico border as an artist and activist for almost 20 years. We're going to discuss her music and her recent trips. Welcome back to the show, Tracy.
Thank you so much, Alan and Nancy. Good to be here this morning.
Yes. So there is so much to talk about. I know you've been, you know, all this border stuff that some of us are just hearing about, you've really been doing for a really long time. I don't know where you would want to start, but I do want to hear about your trip to Tijuana.
Sure. So recently I went on a delegation that included several people from Charlottesville to work with the most recent migrant caravan in Tijuana. And I wanted to mention, actually, that we'll be giving a panel this coming week on Tuesday at Wesley Memorial Church. You know, people who are being compelled and drawn into the struggle for justice and immigration and refugees, really just the movement of people in the world, are awakened in different ways. And certainly this most recent migrant caravan is compelling many people as just the images and the realization that these are mostly families and there's a lot of children unfolds and comes to the front of our minds. But immigration and the borders are everywhere in this country, and certainly a lot of asylum seekers and people crossing our U.S. border end up in Virginia. So we have several asylum seekers here now, including Maria Chavalan Soot, who is living in sanctuary at Wesley Memorial and really teaching us and leading us in the movement here for liberation and justice for migrants. And she's an indigenous woman from Guatemala. So several of us, including the pastor of Wesley Memorial, my dear friend, colleague, Brittany Kane Conley, and Kristen Clarence, who's a local activist and human rights lawyer and attorney who also has done a lot of work along the border, formed a delegation. Also David Baluarte, who leads something similar to Legal Aid Justice at Washington and Lee University. We all went to Tijuana and worked with an organization called El Otro Lado, which means the other side. And they also have been there for decades doing human rights legal work. And as migrants come to the border, many of them, you know, have ideas and hopes about what it will be to cross the border and seek asylum, which are quickly shattered by the realities, not just of the current administration, but of administrations past. So a lot of work is educating people right there on the border, literally trying to catch people that are coming up and making sure they know their rights, preparing them for family separation, documenting their cases as much as they can before they cross the border. And as an artist and a clergy person, I kind of had a unique role. So most of the delegation certainly was lawyers, and El Otro Lado is a legal entity. But there's always a need to identify most vulnerable persons, and often people, you know, there were also trauma care counselors and psychologists, anyone who is trained and equipped to do more interpersonal work has an opportunity to discover a deeper story. And so for my part, I did several things in order to try to help them identify vulnerable peoples. And that would be offering prayer before the Know Your Rights workshop, making myself available and present along with my colleagues and friends who are with me. And that often led to an opportunity to ask just a few questions. And we did identify multiple vulnerable people. The one that I've just been both haunted by and inspired by. Inspired by her courage was a woman, and I can't share too many details because of safety and security and ongoing concerns. But she traveled from Honduras with her four children, the youngest of whom was 6 and the oldest of whom was 14, and was enduring active threats upon her life because the people that were threatening her life were part of a large network of organized crime and gang activity. And so every time she tried to move, they would find her, someone in the network would find her. And most recently, they had found her in Tijuana. And so these shelters were not safe. Working and doing accompaniment work, at one point in time, several of us actually just rode in an Uber car with her to accompany her to try to deter anyone who might be following her from doing something in that moment. And also working, I want to lift up that the local communities and the activists and the faith communities in Tijuana, I mean, obviously they're overwhelmed, but they are also stepping up and they are organized and they are committed. And so again, in this unique space that I found myself in, I was able to connect with a local church that wouldn't have been known. It wouldn't be listed on any a list of shelters in Tijuana. And we were able to at least find placement for her. But, I don't know if she has sought sanctuary or not. They are just being so wise and discerning because it is just life and death if people are able to go and ask asylum and find asylum. And the news that broke on Friday that they're bringing everyone back to Mexico and making them wait in Mexico while their cases go to trial is still, it's life and death.
What news is, I'm not aware of what that was. I didn't know. Angela's nodding.
So the Department of Homeland Security, has been trying to push this, but the administration basically unilaterally said we're instigating this new policy in which asylum seekers, normally what both federal and international law states is that a person comes and stands on the arbitrary nation state line and it says, I fear for my life. I need to seek asylum. That starts or should start a process for that person. And part of that process is making sure they're safe while their case is being uncovered. And so what the administration has said is, okay, you can come and seek asylum, but you can't wait in the United States. You have to wait in Mexico, and then we'll work through all this. And of course, people, asylum seekers here are waiting years and years. I mean, they're really weaponizing bureaucracy. It's completely irresponsible. It is, it's a humanitarian crisis. And yet I imagine the faces of those who are there. I imagine the face of this woman who is brave and fighting for her life and fighting for the lives of her children. We require a wave that that can push through the walls of fear, of racism, of colonialism, and really embrace a humanity and a reality that we are connected. The movement of people has been a reality for all of history.
Tracy, because you have been down there before, I hear you that, you know, it's never been good. I do understand now that, you know, we're doing everything illegally to or disregard the idea of asking for asylum. I was curious, in your interactions with people down there, are you finding that they're able to tell you? Are they more guarded, even though they know what you're down there for? Is there a difference in that, or is that still, is that as you've always experienced it?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, are people forthcoming with their stories and the reason why they're seeking asylum? Yes, people are very honest. And, you know, I think that what I observe is a fair amount of shame and self-blame for experiencing poverty and violence, which, of course, is not true and just part of the fruit of that violence of anyone who's been abused or anyone who's been subjected to the injustice of poverty or anything like that. So I guess with that very human tendency noted, I would say people are forthcoming and they're organized. That's the other thing, is the migrants themselves are organized. This is an exodus that will be recognized in history. And so they have elected leadership tables. I met a young woman who was in her early 20s, who just was so smart, so intelligent and compassionate, who understood her people, who had been elected to the leadership table for the Guatemalans, and particularly Guatemalan women. And so she was really dedicated to advocating for them in the caravan for her people. So yes, they want the stories to be told, and I think that the work now, in reflecting, you know, as faith communities continue to work on sanctuary, there's also a lot of people mobilizing to support asylum seekers with a goal that no one would be ever subjected to our also inhumane and unjust detention centers. I think also history will show those with the kind of shame and horror with which we remember Japanese internment camps and Native American boarding schools, just things that completely dehumanize and destroy what connects us to our humanity and also culture. And so there's people mobilizing to try to sponsor more and more asylum seekers and get them out of detention. I'll stop there.
Yes, we're speaking with Tracy Howe. So I'm so curious about something we do not hear almost at all about, or I don't, and I'm so curious about the U.S. complicity in these situations. You know, migrants fleeing from their countries, and what is the U.S. role in the reasons that they're fleeing that you've seen?
Sure, that's a great and important question. And I think part of why I'm going to Honduras in March, I've been invited to a delegation that's being led by the Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity and working with indigenous and faith communities and activist communities on the ground in Honduras to help illuminate the root causes of immigration in this moment. Because you're absolutely right, Ellen, there is a complicity and an entanglement and an intentional kind of weakening and destabilizing of Central America and many regions in the world in order to protect political, economic, military interests. And so understanding that history in Latin America, and particularly right now Central America, and the colonial history, and that is the physical displacement of people by others using power, and the neo-colonial current reality, which is using economic power to displace and control people. So mining companies and multinational companies that are just extracting and exploiting so many lands and displacing indigenous people. We really want to seek to understand that so that people here, you know, I think when I encounter communities who understand just at a very basic level, we need to work towards a common, equitable, and just humanity, they say, yes, we need to welcome and love our immigrant brothers and sisters, but there isn't a comprehensive or nuanced understanding of the why, and we really need to do this deep work and understand what ramifications it will mean for us policy-wise and economically.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with Tracy Howe, musician, activist, and founder of Restoration Village Arts. In a little bit, we're going to talk with Angela Chalfie, executive director of the Legal Aid Justice Center in Charlottesville. We will be right back. This is Apropos of Something. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We air on Saturdays live from 10 to 11 on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with Tracy Howe. So, Tracy, something interesting I heard about were tell us about the marriages or the weddings in Tijuana.
Yeah. So, Nicole Ramos, who is the director of Al Otro Lado, she really, in our orientation, she reminded us, you know, the reason that we do this ultimately is for love. And so we also need to look for opportunities to celebrate. And so as clergy people there, myself and again, Isaac Collins and Brittany Kane Conley, we were able to offer weddings for people who were going to cross and seek asylum and had not had the opportunity to have any kind of official documentation, either because of financial reasons. There are people who, you know, are for all intents and purposes married for years and have families, but they didn't ever have a church service because maybe they couldn't afford to rent the space or whatever. And then the other big reason is because LGBTQ people were not recognized and not given the opportunity. And so we celebrated a number of weddings, and it was just such a privilege. Such a privilege. And, you know, most of them ended in tears and some kind of song. And we, you know, we had these like little, you know, just token rings to give them, but they were so grateful. And we did this beautiful kind of inclusive interfaith liturgy, but would, you know, ask them what their background is, what marriage, you know, was in their family and in their religious tradition. It was just beautiful. And more importantly, or equally importantly than the celebration of love and human connection, that having that silly piece of paper, that documentation that we were offering, then could be used in their asylum case and also as they cross the border to try to maintain family unity. And El Otro Lado had had a good amount of success in maintaining, at least keeping families together or couples together just by having this documentation. So it was important on both fronts, and just, wow, what an incredible thing to be a part of.
And, you know, Tracy, given this, the administration's desire to eliminate all these protections and criminalize it, I was just wondering if you're even going there to do all these things to interact with people down there, has the planning for that at all been affected by them? Or once you get down there, are they in your way in any ways? Protect, you know, border protect.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The, you know, Mexican police and Mexican Border Patrol is under a huge amount of pressure by the U.S. administration and the U.S. Border Patrol to act in ways that are in our, you know, nation state's best interest, not necessarily how, you know, the state of Mexico would wish to treat asylum seekers and immigrants, or, just what their own policies might be. Mexico in general is pretty generous in recognizing the need to give humanitarian visas. And so some migrants are indeed seeking that who have the option. But again, there are many who don't, and many who are already separated from family members in the U.S. So anyway, it's very complex. And yes, we, you know, working alongside the full-time staff and legal team of El Otro Lado, we were following their lead. And there was one moment when we were working to accompany children, unaccompanied minors who were part of the caravan, and trying to accompany them and make sure they could seek asylum in the U.S. And it was their observation, the legal team from El Otro Lado, that there was a whole new level of militarization. I mean, the children were literally pushed off of the, again, arbitrary U.S. soil that is our border area. And then the Mexican police and the Mexican Border Patrol mobilized. And they were seeing that more and more in ways that were not as common. So, yes, it's precarious and not without risk for anyone involved. But, again, the protection of our own humanity through solidarity and the demonstration of our humanity through this work is just, if we lose it, we lose everything, you know?
So apropos of something has the scoop. You have a new album. This is the first time it's been publicized.
I do. This is the first time we are announcing it. It is coming. Things That Grow March 1st.
Okay. And there's a CD release concert. Is that a public event?
Well, you're hearing it for the first time here.
Okay. So it has to happen.
I am co-heading a concert with Rev Sekou and the Freedom Fighters, an incredible blues band from Nashville, March 4th at The Haven. And I'm so excited. So I'll be doing my CD release concert, doing a full set of the new music. And then Rev Sekou, who's an incredible blues musician and who many people know because he was a part of the activism and training of people in Charlottesville prior to August 12th, and has continued to be a just a beloved friend and presence in our community. He is going to bring his full band, and he's also releasing a live album recorded in Memphis. So it is going to be something really, really special and worth coming to March 4th at The Haven.
Cool.
Tracy, did you always see yourself as a musician / activist? Were they always together, those two titles for you?
That's a great question. In retrospect, I recognize that the same thing that brings out my activism, what brings out my activism is the same thing that brings out my music. I believe that artists are somewhat, they're equipped, but also have some responsibility in documenting and demonstrating and declaring these deep connections we have with one another. That also is what drives my faith and my activism. So I always thought of myself as someone who wanted to witness and know that change was possible. And then once I witnessed that and I saw that, I wanted to be an agent of change myself. And I think that that has been the primary thing. And music has been, because I'm very introverted. And so for years, I mean, as a child, I would just play music and write songs and poetry, and no one else would have known that that happened. So when I guess I was in a community that kind of nurtured the ability to share that music, that came along. But I feel like whether or not I shared that with people, had the opportunity to release albums publicly or not, you know, music would still be a part of my life.
So we have about a minute left. I want to hear about Restoration Village Arts a bit, an organization you founded. It seems really unique that you combine, I guess, you know, it's no surprise knowing who you are, but combining ministry and music and social justice. So tell us a little bit about what goes on there and how you do you have artists come and do retreats and what happens there?
Yeah, absolutely. It really grew out of my own work at the intersections of all these things. I used to call it like the nonprofit was a proverbial wagon that I carried behind myself. And as it's grown, because I've come into relationship with other artists who are doing incredible work and living deep in the trenches of the struggle for humanity, as I would say, and may or may not be known, you know, in the general public, it's become a proverbial kind of tent that can hold and support other artists. So we have had a number of residencies here in Charlottesville that have been lovely. We support the creation of new work for people. We support retreat and time to really sustain the continued work that they're doing. And Yeah, we've supported different projects in their birth and inception as well.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Tracy. Just not enough time. We can't wait to hear about Honduras. So we hope you'll come back for a third time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Ellen
and
Nancy.
Thanks for all your work. I know it's very dangerous down there, but obviously I don't know firsthand. So
yes, thank you for that, for sure. Hey, Nancy, do you have a news of note for us?
Ellen, I have a news of note. Back in America, back in the States, the White House violated the law and violated public trust. And just saying that, I'm sure you have no idea which thing I'm talking about because there are so many. But this one was from last week. This particular violation happened when federal judge Jesse Furman struck down the administration's decision to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. He ruled hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people will go uncounted in the census if the citizenship question is included. And, you know, this question alone would have surely, as he sort of said, you know, would depress the response rates from immigrants, jeopardize the accuracy of the census, which is its purpose, and altered, shifted the power to areas where fewer immigrants are. Obviously, not a coincidence. So he separately, which I loved, you know, ripped Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross for even attempting to add the question, saying that he had the pretext of enforcing the Voting Rights Act, which is what he had said was a lie, that he had cherry picked, badly misconstrued evidence and acted irrationally and thus violated the public's trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
what do you got?
And Wilbur Ross, who just recently said that people who are furloughed should get a loan and how easy that must be, he doesn't understand the problem. Well, federal court recently blocked Wisconsin Republicans' attacks on early voting. So due to the voting rights groups there, they quickly sued in December, and that happened. So as we know, or I learned, early voting, of course, contributes to high turnout. So that was a really good thing. And one thing, other thing I wanted to mention is a new study, 129 transgender and gender nonconforming youth showed that if they were able to use their own name in all situations, they were found to have 71% fewer indications of severe depression, 35% less thoughts of suicide, and 65% less attempted suicides than those who could not use their preferred name. And that's a study published in the Journal of Adolescent Health. So
you know, that's a promise that he, of all the promises he insists on keeping, that's one he had no problem letting go of. Remember how he boasted about his LGBT community that he was such a fan of.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway,
as Richard Painter says, I don't know. I hope his goose is cooked for sure. So our next guest is Angela Chalfie. She is the executive director of Legal Aid Justice Center, or LAJC. She spent 7 years as the legal director at Just Children. And at the center, she has been a prolific and fierce advocate for justice, often leading many of the signature campaigns and cases. She's also litigated significant cases in the Virginia Supreme Court and the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. She has received many, many awards for her work advocating for children's rights issues throughout the Commonwealth. LAJC, I love the way on their website they say, uses a mix of zealous individual representation, group and class litigation, community organizing, policy advocacy to battle poverty and injustice by solving critical legal problems for individuals and communities. Well, welcome to the show, Angela.
Good morning, and thanks for having me on.
Yes, thanks for being here. So I said
Ellen,
a little.
Did you hang up Angela's cape, her superhero cape, before she sat down?
Yeah.
I'm sure she brought it.
Well, today I've got my surgical mask on. I've got kind of a cold, thus the
you
30
can't hear,
voice.
It sounds great, really, on the air. I can hear you sound really great. And I was going to say, you're both of you, Tracy Howe, Angela Chalfie, are really, the theme should be tours de force. Because they're just amazing. So let's hear from the source. Tell us, if you want to tell us a little bit more about LAJC, and then tell us about, since we just talked about immigration, tell us about some of that work you're doing.
That sounds great. At LAJC, we seek equal justice for all by providing direct legal representation, strengthening the voices of low-income communities and communities of color, and really rooting out the inequities that keep people in poverty. And so we are actually kind of a hybrid between your neighborhood legal aid and a statewide civil and human rights organization. So we'll handle your eviction with a lawyer in court, but we will also be working with community leaders and allies in building a campaign to prevent evictions and build affordable housing. We have our hub is here in Charlottesville, but we actually have offices in Richmond, Petersburg, and Falls Church. And as you explained earlier, we use a variety of strategies to accomplish our advocacy. I think some of the most powerful work that we've done has been in the area of or the strategies that we've used to complement what Tracy was saying about partnering with artists to really amplify the advocacy message, which is something we've done particularly in Richmond with Art 180 and Performing Statistics, and engaging with young people to create, who are in the juvenile justice system, to create art that advocates ending the school-to-prison pipeline and reducing reliance on juvenile prisons. I just want to point out that the Legal Aid Justice Center is a nonpartisan art advocacy organization, and some of our most successful partnerships have actually been in building support across the aisle and partnering with even with unlikely allies to bring justice to Virginia. And I think one example of that, if we have time to get into, would be our driver's license suspension campaign. But first, just to tag on to what Tracy was talking about the humanitarian crisis at the border. I think a lot of people think that family separation and some of the biggest travesties that have occurred recently with the change in policy toward immigration is that it's just at the border, but it's not just at the border. And in fact, Virginia is one of the largest, it's the fifth largest receiving state for refugees coming from Central and Latin America. And so that's why we have been really engaged on the immigrants' rights issue. And recently, one of our most recent initiatives has been partnering with the Southern Poverty Law Center and a D.C. law firm of Stern Kessler to file a lawsuit, a nationwide class action on behalf of 10,000 child refugees who are being detained by our federal government in actual detentions that look like jails and shelters all across the country. So in May of 2017, there were about 2,000, just over 2,000, 400 children being held by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is the Human Services Child Welfare arm of our federal government. But as of December 2018, that number had ballooned to 14,600 children.
Wow, that's incredible. In 1 year.
In a year and a half.
Okay.
So why is that? So it's because...
Let me just interrupt you because I feel like this is going to be a great discussion. I want to have no breaks, but I'm going to break now for a hard one, hard break. And we'll be right back with Angela Chofi. This is Apropos of Something, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with Angela Chofi, executive director of the Legal Aid Justice Center in Charlottesville. And we were just talking about how separations of families and detentions and some abuses are not only happening at the border, but are happening all over this country. And if you wanted to continue with that line of thought, we were just talking about the reason that the amount of children being detained, is that what you were saying, has ballooned so much in the last year and a half?
That's right. So we've seen in the last year and a half, the number of child refugees being detained by the U.S. government has gone from just over 2,000 to over 14,000 in December of 2018. And so why is that? It's not because there are greater numbers of children coming into the U.S. It's because of a deliberate strategy to deter vulnerable immigrants from traveling to the U.S. And I say that because a memo that was just released last week by a whistleblower actually demonstrates that the administration intended the very result that the policy of ongoing collaboration between Immigration and Customs Enforcement and ICE and the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is the child welfare arm of the federal government, is was intended to result in the prolonged detention of children in order to be a deterrent effect. So let me give you the story of just one of the 10,000 children that we are currently representing along with the Southern Poverty Law Center as part of this lawsuit. So MCL is 14 years old. She fled Mexico last fall. She was forced to leave her home after a series of events involving a group of violent men. They killed three of her uncles, broke into her family's home, and threatened her at gunpoint. Now, this child, this teenager, was hoping to rejoin her mother in San Francisco, but instead, she was taken to a shelter in Florida, a 2,350 capacity facility that's not subject to state licensure and corresponding child welfare inspections. So this child is one of the 10,000 children currently in federal custody that are being used as bait by ICE to conduct immigration enforcement on sponsors who are often family members applying to reunite with the children who are in custody. Children belong in homes and with families, not warehoused in government detentions and shelters and centers like that. So that's why the Legal Aid Justice Center filed a lawsuit, and actually in August, and as on behalf of children who are being detained right here in Virginia, and then recently amended it last week to make it a nationwide class action.
And the work that you're doing as well for instance, like DACA recipients, right? You have specific, every state has its thing. So I'm sure, what are you facing in Virginia to for them, protections for them?
Yes, we are working to make sure that DACA recipients continue to have access to in-state tuition, which is our legislature is currently convening, and we are working with VACA Lao and the Virginia Coalition of Immigrant Rights on bills to ensure that immigrant students who are residing in Virginia who have DACA status or on the path to permanent residency can access in-state tuition at higher educational institutions, and to give them access to driver's licenses to ensure safety on the roads, and to really separate the public policy of ensuring safety on our highways from the from immigration enforcement.
I wanted to talk about the driving down the debt issue. Can you talk about the way driver's licenses are being suspended and what is wrong with that and that whole issue?
Yeah. So currently in Virginia, if you are a day late or a dollar short on paying your court costs and fines, your driver's license is automatically suspended, not by any court or by any judge after looking at the evidence, but automatically by the DMV. And this obviously has huge effects on people's ability to travel to and from work and maintain employment, to take family members to medical appointments, to pick up kids from school, and to just go about the business of human, the daily business of life. And so I like to say that our Drive Down the Debt campaign, which is about ending the practice of driver's license suspension for unpaid court debt, is not really about driving at all. It's about basic human dignity and the right to survive. So currently in Virginia, nearly 1 million Virginia drivers have a suspended license for failure to pay court costs and fines. That is 1 in 6 drivers. And as you know, in Virginia, where access to public transportation, even in urban areas, is not ideal, having a driver's license is a life necessity, not just a convenience. And so that's why we are in year 4 of a campaign to end that. Started with representing individual drivers who were trying, and individual debtors who were trying to get their driver's license back. And we found that even when people had an attorney, even when they had a letter from their employer saying they'd get a promotion if only they could get their license back, that judges were unwilling to flout the system of automatic license suspension and restore their licenses. And so when we started looking into it more, after we realized there was really not a lot of transparency around this issue. We were able to pass a bill that required courts to post their payment plan policies online. And we, through Freedom of Information requests to the DMV, we found that the problem was so much larger than we expected. And so you're not going to restore a million licenses by taking those cases one by one and putting people on payment plans. That's why we decided to file a class action lawsuit 2 years ago. We were actually originally dismissed for jurisdictional reasons and went all the way back up to the Fourth Circuit, which and the Fourth Circuit gave us an opportunity to amend. When we went back to court earlier this fall, we also filed a motion for a preliminary injunction, which was granted by the federal court just before the holidays. So I'm happy to say that our plaintiffs, among them, Adrian Johnson, who's a mother of three who has been trying to maintain a job within walking distance of her house, now has her license back. Now, that injunction only applies to those five named plaintiffs, but we are working to certify the cases of class so that we can restore the licenses of all the million people and bring justice to them and their families who've suffered under this really devastating policy.
Yeah, according to some of your data, it says black people make up 40% of the pretrial population, but only 20% of the state population. So it's affecting a lot of, you know, it affects black people more, and I'm sure other groups as well.
That's exactly right. It's not just a criminal justice issue. It's a racial justice issue. And in fact, it's an issue of mass incarceration because driving while suspended, where the underlying reason for suspension is not being a dangerous driver, but being too poor to pay, is one of the main reasons that people get locked up in jail. On your third driving while suspended charge, Virginia law requires a 10-day mandatory minimum stay in jail just for trying to drive and meet the needs of your family.
So before I ask you a foreshadow of the school to prison pipeline work that you're doing, this poverty to prison pipeline, is this the most effective way they have this driver's license power, or are they doing other things as well?
Well, there are, you know, we could spend a whole hour or a day talking about criminal justice reform and mass incarceration. I will note that another area that our civil rights and racial justice program is working on is in pretrial justice reform. So on any given night, Virginia jails hold over 28,000 people. That's about 1 in 200 Virginians between the age of 15 and 64, and almost half of those have not been convicted of any crime. They are being held pre-trial. And again, you see the racial disparities. Although black Virginians make up only about 20% of our state's population, they comprise 43% of Virginia's jail population. And that's not just because Virginia, like many states across the country, use money bail and have a wealth-based incarceration system, but it's also because Virginia, and we're an outlier in this regard, the number one decision made by judicial officers considering bail is no bail. It's not just that people can't afford to pay the bail, it's that they're not given bail at all.
So if you're listening to this, and as I have been, wanting to just donate all of my money to both of these organizations, you can do that by going to Justice for All. That's the number 4.org for Angela Chelfie's Legal Aid Justice Center, and then RestorationVillageArts.org. You can contribute there as well as seeing many more details about both organizations and the cases that they are fighting.
So, Angela, again, now that I've tipped my hand, the work, the research that you found, the detrimental effects of schools suspending and expelling students, which inevitably, you know, leads to offenses on their record, et cetera, what have you found from that?
Well, again, you won't be surprised to hear that there are racial disparities in school exclusion rates. We issue an annual report called Suspended Progress, And the 2018 report found that black students were suspended at rates 5 times higher than white students, which is a significantly wider gap than in previous years. And that just Virginia schools continue to suspend very young students at an astonishing rate. They issued nearly 18,000 short-term suspensions and at least 111 long-term suspensions. That's over 10 days to children just in pre-K through third grade. And the vast majority of these suspensions are not for dangerous conduct, but approximately two-thirds of all suspensions are for things like possession of cell phones, minor insubordination, disrespect, and using inappropriate language. And not only do we tend to suspend students, and particularly students of color, for these kinds of subjective offenses, but we also criminalize student misbehavior. Virginia's disorderly conduct statute specifically criminalizes highly subjective student behavior issues that often would not be considered criminal outside the schoolhouse door. So the disorderly conduct statute actually talks about disrupting the school environment with the intent to cause annoyance, inconvenience, or alarm. Now, none of us know any teenagers who ever intend to cause annoyance, inconvenience, or alarm. Mm-hmm. So we currently have a bill pending in the General Assembly that has bipartisan sponsorship to remove the targeting of school misbehavior from the disorderly conduct statute.
And that one obviously is that, in your mind, is that something that could be more quickly remedied than the driver's license legislation that you're...
Actually, I'm very optimistic about both pieces of legislation this year, and particularly driver's license suspension. Our patron is a Republican senator named Bill Stanley, who has been a champion for this cause for many years. He put a bill in last year that passed to repeal the statute that passed the Senate, and I'm happy to report passed the Senate again yesterday. It died in the House last year, but the difference this year is that Governor Northam put in to his budget proposals money to replace the millions of dollars in reinstatement fees that low-income people pay to get their license back. So we believe we've eliminated the last remaining objection to passage of this bill, and we have there's a consensus building around common sense legislation that will, you know, bring relief to almost a million people around Virginia and prevent this scourge from happening to other families.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Wow.
Angela Cholfi, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Justice Center in Charlottesville, and Tracy Howe, activist, musician, founder of Restoration Village Arts, with a new album coming out.
Yay.
What's it called?
Things That Grow.
Things That Grow, yes. March 1st. Look for that. So, Nancy.
Yeah, I'm thinking about things that grow, like music.
Well, what do
you know, maybe I'll just clean a palate with, do a little palate cleanser. Yes, I've got one, Ellen. To relieve stress, there is a thing around the country, not everywhere, but it's called the rage cage, some form of something called a rage cage. It's you go, they provide you with a room. You can break everything you want in this room, at least the one in New York City. You can go for as little as 25 minutes, $45. They supply all the protective gear, so you can just go nuts when you get there. Mm-hmm. They also supply all the anger management tools, like you get a bat, you get a crowbar, you get a sledgehammer, you get your hands. They give you the furniture, they give you laptops, they give you shelves, they give you glasses, dishes. You just, like, it's a menu you select. And it's, you know, as I was reading about it, it's like a combination of a Freud and mixed martial arts, you know, went into business together. This is the kind of therapy they would devise. Anyway, so the rage cage, it is, I don't know if it's all the rage, but it's out there. So that's what I got.
Thanks, Nance. So...
No problem.
Thanks. You know, I'm doing things over here. So next week we have a couple of another pair of amazing guests, Claudrina Harold, and I don't know. I actually don't know how to say Professor Ramazani's first name. Do you, Yahan? We're going to find out. But
I think that sounds, let's just say that that's correct.
Yeah, they're both incredible, and you're going to hear more about that on social media. We're everywhere. AOS Radio.
Social media?
Yeah.
You mean people can follow us on AOS Radio, Twitter, and Instagram, and Facebook?
Yeah, you're
Ellen,
terrible.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes. I'm going to play us out, but thank you, everyone, especially Nancy, especially Tracy Howe and Angela Cholfi for being here. Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. These two are doing their fair share. It's the least we can do. Our music is by Springtide. We'll see you next week.